Would just the park. One could see the long slave auction blocks, the comfortable seats and boxes for the buyers. But what was remarkable was the huge clock face laid out in the hill at the edge. The clock, said Johnny.
Ah, yes, the clock.
The Hoven sighed and glanced at Lord Slime, but his lordship was sitting there, a smile on his mouth below his glasses, fingering his scepter.
The clock is built of slave bones, it is said. Huge masses of them have been inset into wheels that turn and show through the windows. It is said that 58,000 female slaves were killed to make up the border, you see.
I meant the time and date, said Johnny. They are in Tallnep script, and I suppose you read it?
Ah,
said the Hoven, glad to be off the hook. He was afraid Lord Slime might rip into him.
The hour, the date. Why, yes, I do know the Tallnep number system. This was taken about 2 hours ago.
He glanced at his own watch.
About 1 hour and 51 minutes ago, to be exact. Remarkable. Was it taken with the teleportation rig out there just today?
He stared at it.
Must have been.
I do thank you, said Johnny. He took the pointer from the Hoven lord, who then stepped down, casting a somewhat fearful look at Slime. Johnny hit another button. Into view flashed the Tallnep planet and its 5 moons. It was remarkably detailed. Lord Slime, said Johnny, is this the Tallnep planet and its moons? Slime laughed.
It wouldn't do me any good to say no, would it?
Yes, devil. It doesn't take an astronomy professor like our friend the Hoven here to detect that that is Tallnep and its 5 moons.
He laughed easily. Very good, said Johnny. Then, as a native of Tallnep, and someone undoubtedly fond of its moons, could you tell me which moon you like best? This sudden dive sideways made Slime wary. He was only giving it half his attention. There would be a while before the fleet could arrive, he supposed, but they might send a scout racing ahead. He glanced at his watch. He fingered the bottom of the scepter. He was preoccupied with how to get these emissaries outside so both they and the guards could be all taken in at one twist of the scepter bottom.
Well, said Lord Slime, I'm afraid I have better things to do at home than stand around gazing at moons.
Which one of them do you like the least? Persisted Johnny.
Oh, any of them,
said Slime easily. Johnny smiled. The dragon on the helmet flashed and seemed to move as he turned to the emissaries. As Lord Slime has no preference, said Johnny, reaching out with the pointer beam, we will choose this one. Asart, and he tapped it with the light. Notice the peculiar crater patterns, these 5 ellipses, that make this moon distinctive.
A sudden chill hit Slime. Asart.
Covered under its surface were the huge shops and hangars of the entire Tallnep Navy. To this place, local freighters took the parts of space vessels, and on Asart they were reassembled. The mighty non-atmosphere ships of Tallnep could not even take off from a planetary surface. Before every material or crew delivery, all the heavens were combed for hostile surveillance. Before every war vessel launch, surface-fired spy ships rose from Tallnep itself and scanned the skies. The function of Asart was a hard-kept secret. How had this devil come upon such data? Or was it a lucky choice? Slime felt a crawling unease. And then, abruptly, any worry he had was dispelled. The devil with the strange beast on his helmet said, Could I ask all your lordships to come outside? Seats have been placed for your ease, and there will be what I think you will find an interesting demonstration. He had just unwittingly solved Slime's problem. 5. Lord Slime was making very sure that he was the last to leave the room. He wanted nobody left in here. He had noticed that the room had a door and that it had a lock. By leaving last, he could quite naturally close the door and turn the lock. That would be one less door he would have to watch, and he could be certain that nobody lurked in this nearly soundproof room to see what would go on and leap out to surprise him. All the other emissaries filed out. As the one deepest in the room, it was natural that he be the last to leave. The devil had tagged after them, and he was gone. The small gray man had departed. But this confounded host. The elderly man in the fancy Chinese gown seemed to have accumulated some papers, and they were on the floor beside the chair where he had sat. Guest lists, of course. And one must have fallen back of the chair, for he was searching it out. He finally found it, and then stood there going over it, evidently rehearsing some hard-to-pronounce names. So Schleim had to pretend that he had misplaced something, and stood there going through his pockets and looking thoughtful. It was a bit of a strain, waiting the host out. The man did not seem to notice him, but just stood there, running a finger down the list and muttering. "Fine time to rehearse," thought Schleim acidly. In another few moments his own delay would become noticeable. But he had to be sure this was an empty room, too soundproof. And it might have screens in it. He looked about. There was a device in one upper corner. Could it be a viewing device? Hard to tell. Bad light. This projector might also be a viewer. No, he better wait in case somebody should look in here. At last, the host moved with a sort of sailing walk up the aisle to the door, still muttering over his list. Schleim went along right behind him. The Talnap was almost to the door, was even reaching to close it, when the host stopped. Lord Schleim, almost in the doorway now, eyes only for the door, was distracted by two technicians appearing, the same technicians who had set up the projector. They were rushing in to move it. The collision was sudden and violent. The scepter flew from Schleim's hand. A technician caught a glimpse of fangs right in front of his face and raised his arm. Unable to check its forward crush, the technician's heavy sleeve banged into Schleim's mouth. The reaction of a Talnap was inevitable. He bit. He bit hard and repeatedly, hissing in rage as he struck. With a yell, the technician reeled back. He staggered away, holding his sleeve close to his body with the other hand, and vanished into another doorway. The second technician was chattering horrified apologies in some tongue. Chinese? He reached down and picked up a gold object from the floor and shakingly handed it to Schleim. Schleim gripped it. He felt the perforations at the top and the rings at the bottom. He straightened up his glasses and heaved a sigh of relief. At least the scepter was secure. The host was brushing him off with heavy, frantic apologies. The host took a second to gesture impatiently at the second technician, and only then did the hovering man go in and get the projector and wheel it out. Managing to hang back and seem offended, Schleim at last got the room empty and, without the concerned host remarking it, closed and locked the door. Schleim even pretended to limp a bit. He told the host not to mind, and he went to join the others. In the hospital, Dr. Allen and a nurse were getting the Chinese technician out of his jacket. They did it very delicately. Dr. Allen took the padded sleeve and, without touching it, cut it off the jacket and let it fall into a wide-mouthed jar. Drops of poison were visible on the cloth, oozing back up out of the padding. Dr. Allen looked at the arm. In cyclo, he said, "Not a scratch, but a good thing we put the leather lining in. That was a brave thing to do, Chong Wan." The chief ignored his compliment. He threw down a thin knife and a small blast gun.
"He had the knife in the back of his neck and the gun in his boot. I thought we might as well have them, too."
"Are you sure he might not have had something else?" said Dr. Allen. "I don't want to patch up any more holes in Johnny than I have to."
"Nothing else," said Chong Wan, "unless he bat somebody over the head with that scepter."
"I am sure Johnny can duck that if it comes to a fight," said Dr. Allen. "This Lord Schleim is a very dangerous creature." He gestured toward the jar which held the sleeve. "Nurse, Add that to our collection so we can develop some antivenin for it.
6. Colonel Ivan lay in the dark, a flamethrower resting on the sandbags piled before him. He was at the first turning of the underground passages that labyrinth down into the base. At every turn behind him lay more sandbagged abutments, every one of them manned. His beard was singed off. His hands were covered with blisters. In front of him, 50 feet away, the main entrance door, steel-armored, had begun to glow from the pounding it was taking. Hot blast shots were hitting the outside every few seconds. He had pulled his planes back in. When was that? Yesterday? They were out of fuel and ammunition and of no further use in the air. Pilots were scattered below, behind the abutments. His radio antennae had gone out. Was that yesterday, too? It seemed like half a year ago. Every mine they had planted out front had now been exploded. 1,000 mines? And although the terrain out front was carpeted with strange, dismembered corpses, it had not stopped the attack. The door was growing hotter now, gone from red to blue in some spots. How long would it last? How long could he stand the searing heat of it? He wondered what Marshal Johnny was doing. Chief of Clan Fergus lay on his unwounded side, looking along the face of the rock. There was no retreat. The tunnels had caved in behind him. They had the last anti-aircraft gun that would fire. They were not using it to shoot upward now. They had it trained on the spot the enemy would most likely attack to breach the last barricade to the rock. The firestorm that had been Edinburgh roared ceaselessly above the din of small arms fire. How long could old buildings burn? They had thought they had the enemy halted until just now. A new ship was high, high up there. It had just arrived, and it was now sending down plane after plane of troops. There was only Dunaldeen flying now. There he came from the direction of Cornwall, where he had gone to refuel. Why hadn't they listened to MacTyler and crowded everyone into the old Cornwall mine site? Sentiment for Edinburgh. Well, what would Edinburgh be now but ashes? A wave of enemy troops was gathering now, getting ready for an assault upon that other entrance. He hoped Dunaldeen would live through this. The Scots, if any were left, would need him. The chief of Clan Fergus did not think that he himself would. Too much blood was coming from his side. He wondered what MacTyler was doing now.
"Fired low into that first wave," he told the gunner. "And keep firing as long as you have ammunition left. At least we can gae oot in a blaze of glory."
At Singapore, the Scottish officer turned to the blaze-blackened communicator and lowered his infrabeam binoculars.
"I don't understand it."
The Tulnet Marines had been using artillery to pound a hole under the atmosphere armor cable to the north. It had cost them very dearly. They had lost 12 tanks trying to do just that. But a running group of them had rushed up to that distant cable before they could be stopped and had blown a hole wide open beneath it at a cost of 5 Marines. The Scottish officer had fully expected that with the next wave, some of them would get to the powerhouse and turn all their power off and leave them defenseless. But they had suddenly withdrawn. For the past 20 minutes, they had been picking up wounded and salvaging equipment and boarding launch crafts, harassed continually by the terrestrial battle planes. Now they were soaring up out of reach. The Tulnet fleet was circling. Some minutes ago, the anti-aircraft control men had reported all non-Tulnet ships up there had pulled out, one for Edinburgh, 3 more for Russia. Now there were just Tulnets up there.
"They're leaving," said the Scottish officer.
Well, this point at the Singapore mine site had served as a diversion that pinned enemy forces down, and for quite a while, with very light losses. The cost to the enemy had been great. While he watched, the last of his own planes pulled back. None were equipped with door seals to let them fly out of the atmosphere. His planes were landing now. The last one came in. When its motor went off, the silence after all the constant din almost hurt the ears. There was only the sizzle of armor cable. Way to the south and east, black smoke still soared above the ancient ruins of Singapore.
"Those ships up there are heading west?"
the anti-aircraft control officer called across to him.
"Slightly south of west."
"Speed," said the Scottish officer.
"They're still accelerating? Wait, I'm plotting this. On that course, they're going to arrive at Kariba mine site. They must be low on solar charge, because their speed is only about 2 miles a second. They would get to the Kariba site in 37 or 38 minutes.
The Scottish officer said to the communicator, "Warn Kariba ops that about to have company." The smoking terrain all about them showed the hell that flotilla could raise. Without the armor cable, the defenders here would have been dead 10 times over. A bird sang somewhere. Funny, in these charred ruins. The Scottish officer wondered what Johnny was doing just now. Whatever it was, they had better get a move on at Kariba. God, he was tired. Those Tolneps played rough games. If they had not pulled out so strangely, the whole force here at the Singapore mine site, armor power off, would have been slaughtered in another 20 minutes. Yes, they better look alive at Kariba.
7.
It had taken a little while to get the emissaries settled back down outside. Some had wanted to change their breathing cartridges. Another one or two had wanted a bite of something. Others had just strolled around, looking over the inside of the bowl, curious but friendly enough. One of them had gone so far as to haggle with a Chinese among the village refugees over buying a dog. He had never seen a dog before, and he thought it was cute, especially after it snapped at him. He couldn't understand that the Chinese, who spoke no Cyclo, refused. 5,000 credits was a lot of money to pass up. It would buy a house and farm on Splandorf, his home planet. But they were all settled down now, even Lord Slime, who had done an awful lot of wandering about, chin parked most of the time on the rounded top of his scepter. It was night. The platform was lighted with mine spots. The emissaries were seated on benches and in chairs which had been arranged in a half circle just out of the danger range of the huge metal square. Some were still talking to one another, but they were interested. Johnny was standing in the middle of the platform, and for a bit they wondered whether he was going to send himself someplace or something like that. The spotlights flashed off his buttons, and the creature on his helmet seemed to be alive. Interesting, even to a bored lord. "My lords," said Johnny, "may I ask further forgiveness for absorbing your valuable time? But to settle this thing with Slime, I fear we have to have a demonstration. It is a demonstration of excessive appetite. With your permission?" All but the combatant lords and Slime laughed. A demonstration of appetite? Some sort of eating contest? They'd seen those before, but yes, by all means, go ahead. Johnny slapped the wand into his hand twice. Two mechanics came rushing out of the shadows with a very splendidly decorated mine cart. And on the cart sat a dragon like the one on his helmet. It was about 5 feet long. It had wings. It had a neck. And it had a very ferocious head, a gaping fanged mouth, glaring red eyes, and horns. And from head to tail it had spines jutting out all the way along. A gold-scaled, scarlet-mouthed dragon. The mechanics made as if to lift the dragon down off the cart, but Johnny warned them back as though the dragon might bite. Slime guffawed. Engrossed as he was in listening and knowing well it didn't matter what the devil did, he still could not restrain himself.
"That's not a live beast," he hectored. "That's just a painted figure made of clay. There are more like it right over there."
And he pointed toward the unfinished works where they lay unmounted.
"It's just a hollow image."
Theatrics. Good lord. The poor fool thought he could take these lords in like they were children. But the lords looked at him a bit reprovingly for interrupting, particularly the one behind him, who leaned over and said,
"Hush."
Slime looked at him. He was a huge creature who must have had a genetic line back to trees. His skin was bark-like, and he had masses of leafy-looking hair. His arms were about a foot in diameter. Slime decided he'd have to watch this one when he made his move. Not long now. "Forgive Lord Slime," said Johnny. "He has been under a strain and doesn't see well. The Lord's guffawed now." "This beast on the cart," continued Johnny, "is called a dragon. If you look, you will see his mother at the console over there." The lords looked at the bigger dragon that wrapped around the console. They laughed. "His mother." Sir Robert was standing in the door of the ops room. Behind him, Stormalong, with reports in his hand, was arguing with him in a low voice. But Sir Robert was shaking his head. Finally, Sir Robert said audibly, "Let the lad alone," and Stormalong went back inside. Lord Slime had noticed it. Somebody had reported the flotilla somewhere? Maybe he'd have to act faster than he had planned. He cocked an ear at the sky. They would arrive and launch something into the atmosphere he could hear. That was his instruction. "Now, if you will notice," said Johnny, "the dragon on the cart is different from the dragon on my helmet." He pointed to his forehead. "The tiny one has been fed." "Yes, that one on his helmet did have a small round ball in its mouth. A small round white ball." "And the one on the cart is hungry," said Johnny. "For your collection of data on the flora and fauna of various worlds, you should have these facts. This is an imperial dragon. It eats moons and planets." They thought that was a pretty good joke. Rulers were always eating up planets. Imperial diet. Get it? Good joke. The emissaries laughed. They understood it was an allegory they were watching. Clever. Johnny cautioned back the mechanics again, petted the clay dragon on the head soothingly. Then he suddenly put his arms under the neck and belly, the way you might catch a wild beast by surprise, and staggered back. That dragon was heavy. The mechanics whisked away the decorated minecart and vanished. Slime carefully watched them as well as he could see into the shadows. Oh, they just went back and stood there watching. All right, no problem when the paralysis beam was turned on. Johnny had set the dragon down in the center of the platform. And now he did a most interesting thing. He leaned over the dragon's head, and he was talking into its ear. "Very good," said Johnny. "I know you are hungry. So go eat up Asart." Out of their sight, on the other side of the dragon, he reached in, heard a soft, "No," from Angus at the console, and ratcheted down the time fuse lever of the ultimate bomb lying in the dragon's hollow belly to 5 minutes. With the thumbnail of his other hand, he pierced the cap of a smoke bomb used in mines to trace currents of air in shafts. White smoke began to pour from the dragon's mouth in jets. Ferocious. Johnny skipped back off the platform. Angus hit the firing button. Johnny's wand pointed at the dragon. "Go, and don't come back until you have devoured Asart. Go." Wires hummed. The dragon, smoke and all, shimmered and was gone. There was a very small recoil. Johnny looked at his watch. 3.5 minutes to go. He walked back across the platform. There was a cold, cold hangover on it, where it had doubled with the icy space of Asart. "Now, do any of you lords have a picto recorder you can trust?" said Johnny. "I do not want to use our own, since you might not trust it. I want to borrow a picto recorder, one that you can seal, that can't be tampered with." The lord from Thaljapan, an empire of 700 worlds, said he'd oblige. He went to his apartment and got it out of his hamper. He came back and checked the loading. Johnny made him wrap a metal seal around it, and clench it, and make sure it couldn't be tampered with. The two mechanics now rushed to the platform and laid down a gyro cage from a drone. Johnny asked the lord from Thaljapan to lay the recorder in the gyro slots. The lord glanced at the console to make sure it wasn't being operated, glanced up at the poles to be sure they weren't humming, and walked to the center of the platform and put his picto recorder inside the cage, and, as Johnny requested, locked it down. He left the platform. Johnny glanced at his watch. 7 minutes had gone by. That dragon had been laid exactly on the surface of Aesart. The bomb should have gone off 2 minutes ago. This next shot would put the picto recorder well up from that moon and to the side.
Now, said Angus.
The wires hummed. The picto recorder and cage shimmered and vanished. There was no recoil. Numbers on Johnny's watch whirred. 39 seconds. There was a change in the humming. There was a shimmer on the platform. The picto recorder and cage reappeared. The humming went off. There was a slight recoil. Two mechanics rolled up the dolly the projector sat on so that it was among the emissaries. Now, if you please, my lord, said Johnny to the foul Japan, would you please retrieve your recorder and take it to the projector and unseal it? And please be certain that it is your disc, by putting a few words on the end of it. Then make sure there is no other disc or trace in the machine, and put your disc in, if you please. Lord of Foul Japan did exactly as requested.
The recorder is ice cold, was all he said.
Johnny held his breath. He had a pretty good idea of what the bomb did, but he was not sure. This was the touch-and-go moment. He hit the remote. Off went the spotlights. On went the recorder picture. There in the dark before them was Aesart, three-dimensional. There were the 5 ellipses which identified it. Used to bombs and explosions, they had indifferently expected to see some high tower of dust or smoke. Actually, they had not thought, most of them, that much would happen. Johnny had been so calm, so polite, certainly not in a mood in which one engaged in war. They didn't see anything strange for a moment. And then, as the picture rolled off the disk, they saw a hole occurring in the upper right surface of Aesart. Just a hole. No, there was a bit of black around the edge of it. Schleim, ear cocked at the sky, felt a jar of alarm. What in the name of 50 devils was going on here? But he relaxed. Bombs went boom. There were no bombs that made just a hole. The picture went off, and Foul Japan's My Voice Here came on.
Theatrics, laughed Schleim. You're engaging in nonsense.
My lords, said Johnny, does another one of you have a picto recorder I can borrow? Yes, my lord Dom had one. He went and got it, and they went through the same procedure as before. Angus updated the time, cast the recorder to a new angle, and got it back. Lord Dom, a little bit frightened at the implications of this to the 1,200 worlds of his republic, had a quaver in his voice when he put it on the disk. Johnny hit the switches. Aesart gleamed in the dark before them. About 1/100th of the moon had become a hole edged in curling black clouds. And just before the view went off, down in the lower left, it looked like a door had opened in the crust, not part of the growing hole. A breath of terror trembled through the gathering, but Johnny was not going to let it become a riot. You see, my lords, the dragon was hungry. He laughed lightly. He is also a very obedient dragon. Told to eat the moon, he is eating Aesart. A very controllable dragon, after all. Had he hit them with ice water, he could not have produced a more chilling effect. Their eyes focused on him in growing horror. Schleim broke the spell. It had occurred to him that he had a new way to guarantee success. He had a spare gun in his hamper, as well as a recorder. He had just felt in his boot and discovered the weapon gone. Damn that valet. Hovind's slaves were never any good.
All you are doing, said Schleim, is casting that recorder out somewhere to a model you've made in the hills. And you have people regulating a model for it to photograph. You're a fraud.
And Schleim really believed it. But he had to make sure before he went off the edge.
There's a recorder in my hamper.
Go get it, said Johnny.
Schleim rushed to his apartment. He scrambled through the hamper. Ah, not just a spare gun, but also a spare scepter hidden in the bottom, a spare with another paralysis beam in its heel. He could leave one on in a chair while he carried the other one out to turn the power cable off.
Ha ha, 3 blast grenades.
After he turned the beam on, he'd pitch one into the ops room and use the other two to silence anyone rushing out of another door. Perfect. He wouldn't torture the Hoven slave after all. Good fellow. Schlime carried the whole hamper back to the gathering and set it beside his chair. Cautiously opening it so they wouldn't see what else was in it, he removed the picto recorder. It was a different make and type, but it played a disc.
"Devil," said Schlime, "we will end your fraud here and now. You would not know, not being a native of a proper planet, that on the back of Ace Sart is a huge diamond with a slash. It is done with hyperband nullifying material to act as a navigation and identification marker. It is unknown to practically everyone except a fleet officer. The marker will not show up on your standard recorders. And you have none like this one that takes the hyperspectrum as well as what you call visible light. It will show that diamond and slash. Yours won't. So, of course, you didn't put one on your fake model. I am about to expose you as the fraud of all time."
He sounded confident. But before that rig was destroyed, he really had to know. Was it a model up in the hills, or was that Asart? If it was Asart, should he be sure his torturer got the secret of teleportation? What a weapon. He slithered over and put his recorder into the gyro cage, sealed the cage shut with a claw pattern, and walked off the platform. Angus had heard it all. He shifted coordinates so that the recorder would view both the back of Asart and the hole. He fired it and recalled it, and when the recoil died, Lord Schlime raced up to it, checked the claw pattern. It had not been broken. He came back to the projector. He made absolutely sure it was not projecting something else. He put,
"This is Lord Schlime," on the disc and put it into the machine.
Did his ear detect a far-off whine in the sky? 8. Lord Schlime felt there would be no diamond and slash beacon in the picture that would, in a moment, be shown. Only Tolnep eyes would ever detect that, and only a Tolnep-modified picto recorder could film it. He would use this moment to distract the others. Yes, that was a whine in the sky. The fleet would be over them in moments. The timing was just right. How clever of him. But he had a well-deserved reputation as a slippery diplomat. Formidable, in fact. He walked over to his chair, made very sure his hamper was well within reach. He glanced back at the assembled emissaries. They were all craning forward, tensely, waiting for the picture to come on, totally off guard. He spotted exactly where the devil was standing, slightly in front of them all, and well clear of the projector. Schlime fingered the bottom ring of the scepter.
"Turn on the latest picture of your fake model," jeered Schlime.
Johnny hit the buttons. Off went the mind spotlights. On went the three-dimensional picture of Asart. It was a new angle. It showed the backside of the moon as well as some of the front. Filtration gave it a bluish hue, but it was Asart. It seemed to float hugely before them. And right there in the center, massive and unmistakable, was the diamond and slash insignia of Tolnep, jet black on the surface of the moon. Schlime gasped. It was real. That really was Asart. One of the ends of the slash was supposed to point to a hangar door, and even as they looked, that door finished opening, the huge, yawning mouth of a Tolnep-made cavern. The moon had deflated further now. It resembled a blue balloon with one side being poked relentlessly in, a great pucker that was growing bigger now and at a more rapid rate. What appeared to be black gases were eddying up to fill the sunken part. And then, out of that yawning hangar, bolted a war vessel. Although it must have been traveling very fast, the enormous size of it caused it to seem to move in slow motion. At least 30,000 tons of Tolnep capital ship was seeking to escape into space. But it was too late. It had already been touched by the pucker within the moon. A whole back section of the ship was gone. Before the fixated eyes of the delegates, the vast space vessel was eaten up from tail to nose, its massive metal turned to gases. Other hangar doors were starting to open. But that was the extent of the picture. One last puff of black gas as the final bit of capital ship was overtaken by disaster, and the recorded voice said,
"This is Lord Slime."
Slime screamed. Then he acted. He popped his earplugs shut. He leaped up. He wrenched at the bottom ring of the scepter and, as though it were a machine gun, swept it in an arc from left to right to freeze them all.
"Paralyze!" screamed Slime. "Stand dead! Damn you, stand dead!"
It wasn't happening fast enough. There was a surge of emissaries away from him, some falling. He snatched the other scepter from the basket. He twisted the bottom ring and swept it all around, taking in guards in rifle pits. They were not falling quickly enough. Slime dove into the hamper and came up with three grenades. With all his considerable might, he hurled one into the open door of the ops room. He sent another at the bowl entrance. He hurled the third at the devil. Before they could even land, such was his speed of reaction, he had the gun out of the hamper. He lined it up on the devil, square at his face, 30 feet away. With joy, he pulled the trigger. It did not fire. Lord Dom, a bulbous creature from a mostly liquid world, was bouncing to his feet and coming at him. Slime raised the pistol on high, preparing to bring it down on Dom and splatter him. A Tallnep could physically smash them all. Straight as a sizzling arrow, Johnny threw his knob carry. The hard butt end smashed into Slime's eye filters. Lord Browl, the massive tree-like emissary, who had sat behind him, wrapped Slime in foot-diameter arms and held him from behind in a creaking vise.
"Hold him still," shouted Foul Japan. "Don't let him touch his body."
With a flick of his wrist, Foul Japan snapped a beak-like knife into his right claw and advanced upon Slime. The Tallnep struggled, but the huge arms held. Foul Japan peered with beady eyes all around the steel-like neck of the Tallnep.
"Ah," he said finally, "there is the half-healed incision."
His knife moved in and began to cut. Gray drops of Tallnep blood oozed from the shallow gash that was being made. Foul Japan squeezed the wound, and a fragile glassine capsule popped out of it. It was intact.
"His suicide capsule," said Foul Japan. "All he had to do was strike the side of his neck, and he would have been dead."
He looked reprovingly at Johnny.
"Had you hit this with that throwing stick, we would have had no defendant."
It was Johnny's first intimation that all was not going to go exactly as planned, and that all was not well. Foul Japan turned to the others, now crowding around. He shouted in a squalling voice,
"Is it the will of the conference that this emissary be under conference arrest and be brought to trial?"
They thought. They pondered. They looked at one another. One said something about invoking Clause 32. Johnny could only think of getting in there and getting the war stopped now. Didn't these lords realize people were dying? And as for Slime, hadn't they seen him try to use weapons on all of them? But he had collided with the ponderous idiocies for which governments and courts were renowned. There was even a growing whine in the sky. It threatened their own safety.
"I move that he be properly tried," a lord at the back called out.
"All those in favor?" shouted another.
All non-combatant lords said, "Aye." The combatant one said, "No."
"I hereby declare," said Foul Japan, "that the emissary of Tallnep is a prisoner of the conference and is to be duly tried under Clause 32, threatening physical violence to the conference."
That whine in the sky was much louder now. Johnny shouldered his way through. He got right in front of the Tallnep. He pushed a scepter at his face. "Is this what you were looking for, Slime? This is the real one. The others were just copies we made. Duds like the rest of your weapons." Slime was struggling and screaming.
"Get me some chains,"
shouted Foul Japan. Johnny came close to the Tallnep's face, but Foul Japan was prying in among Slime's teeth to make sure there were no other capsules to bite down on. The moment that was done, Johnny spoke again. "Slime, tell your captain up there to draw off. talk or I'll shove this radio down your throat. Lord Dom tried to push Johnny away.
This is a conference prisoner. He may not be communicated with until tried. Clause 51, governing trial procedures.
Johnny somehow controlled his temper. Lord Dom, this conference is at this very instant under threat of bombing. For its own safety, I demand that Schlime...
Demand? Said Foul Japan. Hear now, those are very strong words. There are certain procedures that must be observed, and you are hereby officially informed that you yourself threw an object at an emissary. The conference...
To save his life, cried Johnny, pointing at Dom. This Tallnep would have crushed his skull.
You were acting then, said Foul Japan, as master-at-arms of this conference?
I do not recall any appointment. Johnny took a breath. He thought fast. I was acting as the appointee of the host planet, which is responsible for protecting the lives of invited delegates. He knew of no such procedure.
Ah, said Lord Dom. He is invoking Clause 41, responsibilities of the planet responsible for assembling emissaries.
Ah, said Foul Japan. Then you cannot also be charged. Where are those chains?
A Chinese guard was running up with coils of jangling mine hoist chains. Two pilots followed him with another tangle of heavy links. Under Clause 41, said Johnny desperately, I must demand of the prisoner that he surrender his offensive forces at once. Lord Dom looked at Foul Japan. Foul Japan shook his head.
All that can be arranged, per Clause 19, is a temporary suspension of hostilities where warfare threatens the physical safety of a conference.
Good, said Johnny. He knew he was at risk. These emissaries were not as friendly now. But he would push it all he could. He had to save lives. Not only theirs, but those of any survivors of Edinburgh. He shoved the radio close to Schleim's mouth. Declare an immediate suspension of hostilities, Schleim, and tell that captain up there to draw his forces off. Lord Schleim simply spat at them. They were wrapping him in chains now. Somebody had found a spare filter in the hamper and replaced the shattered ones over his eyes so he could see. They had him on the ground, and he looked like a huge coil of hoist chain. Only his face was visible now. His lips were drawn back, and nothing but hisses were coming out of him. Johnny was about to rage at him that if he didn't talk into this radio, the planet of Tallnep would get one big dragon. The thought that this, too, might violate something made him hesitate for a moment, searching for words. Lord Dom accidentally solved it before Johnny could speak.
Slime, said Lord Dom. I am sure it will go much easier with you at your trial if you call off your forces.
This was the bit of grass that Slime had been wriggling to get.
On that condition, and if the captain of that fleet up there will forego his piratical venture and follow my orders, give me the radio.
It was promptly shoved at his mouth by a Johnny who would rather have smashed his fangs in with it. No codes, just say, I have hereby declared a temporary suspension of hostilities, and you are ordered to withdraw into orbit remote from all combat areas. Schlime looked at the faces above him. When Johnny pressed the hidden talk switch, Schlime surprised them all by saying exactly what Johnny had told him to say. But was there a lurking smile on the Tallnep's mouth? Some prearrangement or regulation must be going into effect up there in space. Rogo Dieter Snell's voice came back through the scepter.
It is my duty to inquire whether the emissary of Tallnep is under any physical threat or duress.
They looked at each other. It was obvious that Tallnep naval regulations covered such sudden and otherwise inexplicable orders. Schlime, wrapped to the chin in heavy mine-hoist chain, smiled.
May I speak to him again?
Tell him to comply at once, said Johnny. He didn't want to make an overt threat against the Tallnep planet in this company and at this time. Again, Schlime said exactly what Johnny had told him to say. Rogo Dieter Snell's voice came back.
I can only comply if I am assured that the personal safety of the emissary of Tallnep is guaranteed, and that the conference promises to return him unharmed to the planet Tallnep.
Thal Japan said to Lord Dom,
It simply precludes execution.
By Clause 42, said Lord Brow, a trial can still be held. It is quite normal. I move we guarantee this emissary's safe return as a personal matter. All those in favor?
The eyes came back, unanimous this time. Thaljapan was looking around.
Where is...
The small gray man appeared among them. He took the scepter from Johnny. He looked around at the faces of the lords, and then, as they nodded, he spoke into the mic. First, he gave a code word, followed by a peculiar buzz which seemed to come from the lapel of his gray suit. Then he said,
Captain Snell, it is certified that the emissary of Talnep will be returned, physically unharmed, to his planet in due course, but not with any unreasonable delay.
Snell's voice came back.
Thank you, Your Excellency. Please inform the emissaries that I will honor a temporary suspension of hostilities, and at this moment am withdrawing to an orbit clear of this and all combat areas. End transmission.
Johnny was pointing at the emissaries of the other combatants. They were the ones wrecking Edinburgh and Russia. Lord Faljapan, said Johnny, I am certain any temporary suspension of hostilities includes all combatants.
Ah, said Faljapan. He thought. We have no guarantee that only Talnep ships were up there. It would be irregular for these others not to agree.
But the Bolbod, Draken, Hovin, and other combatant lords were pointing at Sir Robert, who was standing outside the ops room.
We agree, shouted Sir Robert with an expression of disgust for their delays.
The combatant emissaries started to look around for communication facilities. A mob of communicators with mics rushed out and almost knocked them down. With a spatter and batter of many tongues, the other combatants ordered a temporary suspension of hostilities for all their ships.
Good God, thought Johnny. All this while men went on dying. It was still very touch and go. No one had said hostilities would not be resumed, and with even greater ferocity.
And who was this small gray man who exerted such power over them? Where did he fit in? Who was he? What would he want out of all this? Another threat? 9. The emissaries were dragging Schleim off when Kwong, Sir Robert's Buddhist communicator, ran up to Johnny.
Sir Robert asks me to tell you, whispered the boy, that there will be a sudden exodus in a moment, and not to be alarmed. They have been working it out in ops for the past half hour, and the orders are being issued this instant. There are hundreds of people trapped in shelters in Edinburgh. The tunnel corridors and entrances fell in under heavy bombs. They do not know how many are alive or anything else. He says it is like a caved-in mine. They are leaving in minutes, and he wants you to carry on here. If needed, he will come back.
Johnny felt like a cold hand had gripped his heart. Chrissy and Patty were part of that, if they still lived.
I should go, said Johnny.
No, no, said the boy Kwong. Sir Robert said you would say that, Lord Johnny. They will do everything that can be done. He said to tell you he is leaving all this in your hands.
At that moment, pandemonium broke loose. Sir Robert raced out of the ops room. He had somewhere changed his clothes, and the gray cloak billowed as he donned it on the run.
Goodbye, Lord Johnny,
said Kwong, and raced away. Sir Robert was at the passage, waving his arm with an urgent swing.
Come on, he bellowed. Come on!
Doctors McKendrick and Allen sped out of the hospital area, shutting valises as they ran. Allen turned and shouted something at the nurse, and then sped on. The walking wounded hobbled and limped out, heading for the passage. Four pilots raced by. Guards, who a moment before had been covering Schleim from pits, were yelling to one another, and a soldier carrying several packs raced toward them, and then they were gone. A crowd of officers and communicators slammed out of ops and headed for the passage exit. Suddenly, Johnny was aware of the turmoil and commotion among the Chinese. Mothers were dumping babies, and a screech of instructions at older daughters, and then running to the exit. The Chinese men were snatching up bits and pieces from their personal baggage, shooing smaller children into the vicinity of the half-grown girls, yelling at each other to hurry. Dogs, snapped onto leashes that were pushed into the hands of young boys, set up a cacophony of barking and howling at being made to stay. A plane motor started up, then another. Three Scott pilots ran out of the ops room, getting into flight clothes and gripping maps. And all the time, Sir Robert was at the exit, shouting, "Come on, come on!" From the open door of ops, Stormalong's voice was rising above the din. "Victoria? Victoria! Damn it, man, keep your radios manned. Take every mine pump you've got, every atmosphere hose and pump. Got that? I know it's in clear. All right." A woman communicator in there was taking over. She started to chatter Polly. "Come on," Sir Robert was shouting at the delaying few. "Damn it, Edinburgh is burning." A plane took off. Sir Robert was gone. Another plane. Another, another, another. From the whip of sound, they were lancing up to hypersonic in seconds. Johnny wondered whether they were leaving any aircraft at all. Lord Dom came over to Johnny. His big, liquidy face looked a bit concerned.
"What's happening? Are you abandoning this area? You realize that in a temporary suspension of hostilities, it is irregular to use it to arrange the redisposition of military forces to achieve the advantage of surprise when hostilities are resumed. I would caution..."
Johnny had had just about enough of being chinko polite for one day. He was worried about Chrissy and Patty, and very concerned about his village people who had gone to Russia. "They are on their way to try to dig hundreds of people out of collapsed shelters," said Johnny. "I don't think your rules apply to non-combatants, Lord Dom. And even if they did, not even you could stop those Scots. They're on their way to save what they can of the Scottish nation." Johnny walked into ops. The place was in a shambles left by the hasty departure. Only the Buddhist woman communicator and Stormalong were there. She had finished her messages and was sitting back, head bowed, exhausted. They had been on straight duty for days without rest. This was the first lull. "Russia?" said Johnny to Stormalong. "I sent the whole contingent at Singapore there over half an hour ago. They took everything they had. It's just a flight over the Himalayas, and they'll be there in another couple of hours. I don't know what they'll find. We haven't heard from Russia for a couple of days."
"Edinburgh?" said Johnny.
"Nothing for the last hour."
"Did I hear you sending everyone at Victoria to Scotland?" said Johnny. "What about the prisoners there?"
"Oh, they gave Kerr a blast rifle."
He saw Johnny's look.
"Kerr says he'll blow their heads off if they so much as move an eye bone. They left that old woman from the Mountains of the Moon to handle their diets. And all your vital notes are safe..."
He was about to add, "here," when he saw Lord Dom at the door and looked at him. Lord Dom said,
"I didn't wish to intrude, but I couldn't help overhearing. Haven't you left this whole conference area, maybe this whole continent, maybe the planet, without air cover?"
Johnny shrugged and pointed to Stormalong. "There's he and I." This startled Lord Dom. He quivered a bit. Stormalong laughed and said,
"Why, that's twice as many as there used to be. Not long ago, there was just him."
He pointed at Johnny. Lord Dom blinked. He stared at Johnny. The young man didn't seem worried at all. Lord Dom went off and told his colleagues about this. They discussed it considerably among themselves. They decided they had better keep a careful eye on Johnny. 10. Johnny stood outside the ops room door and looked around the bowl. How quiet it seemed. The older Chinese children had quieted the younger ones and gotten them to bed. The dogs were silent, exhausted from the excitement of a while ago. The emissaries had all gone off to their apartments or guard duty over slime. There were no sentries in sight. The place seemed deserted, even though it was not late yet. To one brought up in the silences of mountains, the calm was welcome. It might be the sort of calm that is followed by blasting storm, but it was a moment's calm. Too many situations were running all at the same time for him to have any peace of mind. Who knew what would happen as a result of the emissary trial? He did not trust them. What would occur after this temporary suspension of war? What would they find in Edinburgh, in Russia? He told himself he had better not let his mind dwell long on these last two places, or he would edge over into anxiety and grief. That book he had read, that said you could handle things if you did one of them at a time? Good advice. Cyclo. He had been living in such a tornado that the question of Cyclo had become a sort of dull pain like a toothache. Was there any danger of counterattack, or was that just a shadow? Ha! This was a thing he had been waiting for. He had a transshipment rig. It was in fine working order. There were no planes in the air, no motors running. Cyclo. He would end right now that question of threat. He strode over to the console and almost fell over Angus. The Scot was sitting in a pool of light, working intensely with some rods and wheels. He didn't look up, but he knew Johnny was there. "While you were settling up with Schleim," said Angus, fingers flying around his work, "I parked a pictorecorder on a peak on Tolnep to watch that moon. Reaction motors don't mess up a firing, only teleportation motors do. So I just fired it. But that was the only gyro cage assembled. I'm putting together a spare." "Angus," said Johnny, "we're going to find out what happened to Cyclo. We've got the machine, we've got the time." "Give me about half an hour," said Angus. Johnny saw he needed no help, and he wasn't going to stand around here and wait. En route to his room, he looked in at the hospital. They had left a woman nurse, an elderly Scot, and she resented being left behind. She looked up from a patient as Johnny entered. "It's time for your sulfa and your shot," she said threateningly. Johnny knew he shouldn't have come in here. He had just wanted to see how the wounded were doing. The two fractured skull cases were lying in their beds. They seemed all right. But being Scots and left behind, they eyed him dully. The two burned anti-aircraft gunners seemed all right, but being Scots, they didn't want to be there with Edinburgh burning. "Take off your jacket," snapped the nurse. Then she took the bandage off his arm and looked at the arrow wound. "Ha," she said, sounding disappointed. "It won't even leave a scar." She made him take sulfa powder and wash it down with water. She jabbed an inch of needle into his good arm and squirted B-complex, stingingly, with a savage thumb. She took his temperature and counted his pulse. "You're perfectly well." It sounded like an indictment. Johnny had had a lot of practice in diplomacy that day. He felt sorry for these people. Jacket and helmet dangling from his hand, he said, "I sure am glad you people stayed. I may need lots of help defending this area." After a moment of amazement, they all came alive. They said he could count on them. And when he left, they were all chattering about what they could do and smiling, even the nurse. With the exodus of the adult Chinese, he hadn't really expected to find Mr. Tsung. But there he was. He had laid out a blue jacket on the bed along with some other items for change. But he was bowing and beaming. With his hands tucked in his sleeves, he was going up and down like a pump. He was trying to say something, but his English wasn't up to it, and suddenly he bolted and came back with Chief Chong Wan. "Well, at least you're here," said Johnny. "I thought the place was near empty."
"Oh, no," said the chief. "The coordinators are all gone. But we have guests, you know. The emissaries. So I am here, and the cook. There's an electrician and two anti-aircraft gunners."
He started counting off on his fingers.
"Maybe a dozen people left. We do have one problem."
He saw Johnny go alert.
"It's the food. I thought we'd be feeding all these emissaries, and we got ready to fix the fanciest Chinese food you ever heard of. But they don't eat our food. So we have all this food and nobody to eat it. Too bad."
To a people who had been pressed starving into the snowy mountains for centuries, it must look like quite a tragedy. "Feed the children," said Johnny.
"Oh, we have, said the chief. "Even the dogs. But we've still got lots too much food. I tell you what we'll do.
There's an empty apartment, and we'll set it up for a dining room, and we will feed you a beautiful dinner.
I've got something to do, said Johnny.
Oh, no problem, no problem. It is very stylish to eat late. The cook will be so pleased. Here.
And he made a dash outside to the hall and brought back a tray with some soup and small patties of dough and meat.
These are